they are free and they have no record. And if that's not an exoneration, I'm not sure what is.
The Alaska Innocence Project celebrates the outcome of the Fairbanks 4 case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage teenager finds a stable home with a friend's family.
I honestly forgot people lived in houses. I really did, because of how many times I've been in apartments or shelters.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Two Alaskans are among dozens of federal inmates who will be freed decades early, the White House announced today. President Obama today commuted the sentences of Alex Contreras of Anchorage and Raymond Allen Thomas of Fairbanks. Contreras was sentenced to 40 years in 2002 for multiple drug and gun possession charges. He was 19 at the time. News accounts of his sentencing say his convictions relate to his role in an Anchorage drug ring. Thomas was in his 50s when he was convicted of possession of cocaine with intent to sell in 2005. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner says the case against Thomas arose from a kilo of cocaine that was sent in the mail disguised as a Christmas present. He was originally sentenced to 22 years. The sentences for both Alaskans are now to end in April. In all, Obama commuted sentences for 95 convicts. George Freese, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Pease are spending their first day out of prison today in 18 years. They were released yesterday in Fairbanks after the court approved a settlement in the case of the murder of 15-year-old John Hartman. The other member of the Fairbanks Four was Marvin Roberts, who was paroled earlier this year. The outcome is a big win for the Alaska Innocence Project. Executive Director Bill Oberle spent the last 6 years trying to free the men. He describes the scene yesterday, right after the judge left the courtroom.
When the judge walked off the bench, there was sort of a moment of silence, and just, I think, Pia was sinking in, and then the whole place exploded, and cheers and tears and hugs, and that lasted through to the gathering at the tribal hall in Fairbanks, which I left 10:30 or 11, and it was still going strong.
What is included in the settlement? There's been some confusion about whether the men are maintaining their innocence.
There should be no confusion about that. They have been and will always maintain their innocence because they are innocent. The parties agreed and the court signed off that there was new evidence not presented in court in their trials that in the interests of justice demanded new trials. So their convictions were vacated, which took it back to the pretrial stage. And then the state dismissed their indictments. So that means they have no convictions. They stand convicted of no crimes. When they fill out an application, if it says, have you been convicted of a felony, they can check no. And they got out yesterday. So from the four young men's point of view, that's what we went in looking for when we first filed in 2013. That's what we got.
The Attorney General, the State Attorney General, says this is not an exoneration. What does he mean by that? And how much does that matter to you or to the young men, the Fairbanks Four?
Well, what he means by that, you're going to have to ask the Attorney General, because they are free and they have no record. And if that's not an exoneration, I'm not sure what is. So under my definition, and I think under the dictionary definition, this is an exoneration. And that, you know, that means a lot to the boys. They would not they would not have resolved this if they had to maintain convictions. Their two requirements were, we want our names cleared and we want to get out. And anything less than that, they would not have taken.
As part of the agreement, the four men cannot sue the state for compensation for being incarcerated. Is it unusual to give up that ability to sue for compensation from the state?
To be honest, Laurie, I don't know. I know that in other jurisdictions, exonerations, there are other terms. You know, it's a negotiation. It's not something that the young men wanted to give up, but it was something that the state required. If they wanted to get out now, as opposed to wait for the judge's decision, and they did not want to spend more time in prison.
Bill, after spending 18 years in prison, the road ahead won't be easy for the four men. Based on Other Innocence Project work around the country, what do we know about how difficult it is to rejoin society after so many years in prison?
Well, Laurie, I think it is individual dependent. The examples of people who have been exonerated in other states kind of runs the gambit. But in every case, it's difficult. From my understanding is there is a honeymoon period where the things keep getting better and better, and then there is a time where they crash. These young men have a whole community, a whole state that is ready to support them. So I'm hoping the inevitable crash when it comes will mean the people who are around them step up and help them. You know, they walked out of prison with nothing. Things that they had collected in prison, you know, a television, books, things like that, they gave away. They left it at the facility, and they left only with their paperwork and nothing else. They didn't have a toothbrush. And I'm not sure if they even got one last night. That was one of the things people realize late in the evening. We haven't got him a toothbrush yet.
Bill Oberle is executive director of the Alaska Innocence Project. The state's Department of Law maintains the Fairbanks Four were not exonerated in the settlement or completely cleared of blame. John Skidmore is the director of the criminal division of the state's Department of Law.
The agreement or settlement that the state reached yesterday with the men in the Fairbanks Four case was that they were admitting that they were properly and validly convicted when the convictions were entered back in 1996. And it was only new evidence that suggested that it would be difficult to convict them if we were to try them again.
Skidmore says if significant information is found that suggests the men were involved, they could be tried again. He says the recent litigation surrounding the case was bad for the state.
We took this action to try and allow the community to come together and to begin a healing process by putting an end to all of this litigation. But the Department of Law's point, and I hope that others are able to respect this, is that the original convictions were properly and validly obtained. The lead detective, Aaron Ring, did nothing wrong. The Fairbanks Police Department did nothing wrong. The people who prosecuted the case did nothing wrong.
Governor Bill Walker issued a statement yesterday saying he was pleased with the agreement. Congress has finished its work for the year with a $1.8 trillion spending bill, which President Obama quickly signed. The package drew a mixed response from Alaska's delegation. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted for it. She lauded its support for programs important to Alaska in veterans affairs, defense, and social services. The bill also contributes $7 million toward the $1 billion effort to build a new icebreaker. Murkowski said in a recorded press announcement the bill isn't as expensive as it could have been.
It does represent the lowest level of discretionary government spending as a percentage of GDP that we've seen in at least a decade.
Senator Dan Sullivan voted against the package. He said in a written press release it was a tough vote for him because the bill includes many Alaska priorities he fought for. But he objects to the process. The bills were negotiated among a few congressional leaders and the White House. Sullivan says he had only 72 hours to read 2,200 pages and couldn't in good conscience vote for it. Alaska Congressman Don Young in a recorded statement said the bill wasn't great, but better than nothing.
I could have voted no, I voted yes, because I knew that the last time we closed the government down is a bad thing for the nation. It costs us money over the long run.
Young says the package should have been built through the normal congressional process. On the other hand, he says it has important reforms and Alaska provisions that wouldn't otherwise become law. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new documentary highlights a catch-22 Alaska villages face.
Because they were successful in preventing a disaster from happening, no disaster, no money.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University delivers an affordable education and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2016 and find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
For years, researchers studying permafrost in the Arctic have seen a warming trend. Now scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks say it is happening even faster than expected. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
Vladimir Romanovsky heads up the permafrost laboratory at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Geophysical Institute. Based on three decades of study, he says the trend is more dramatic than previously thought.
Even on the North Slope, the depth of summer thaw is increasing. We're getting pretty close now and closer to that threshold of beginning of thaw of permafrost.
Romanovsky and his team drew data from several models as well as their own on-the-ground observations. They entered the data into a special permafrost model, and from that they developed two scenarios. One projects the consequences of modest reductions in global CO2 emissions. In that scenario, the resulting thaw is largely confined to the North Slope's Brooks Range. The second scenario assumes today's CO2 emission rates continuing. In that case, more than half of the permafrost on the North Slope and coastal plain would be thawed by next century. Romanovsky says as ice-rich soils melt, the thawing will be dramatic to ecosystems and infrastructure.
At one place, you can have like half-meter settlement and another just a few meters from that, or almost none. And that's the most dangerous for infrastructure because the surfaces became very uneven.
Romanovsky's findings were reported at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. In Fairbanks, with help from Lakedra Chavis of KYUK, I'm Robert Hannon.
On Sunday evening, the issue of Alaska coastal erosion will be featured on the Al Jazeera America program, Fault Lines. The correspondent for the story is former APRN reporter Libby Casey. She says they highlighted Newtok and Kivalina on the northwest Arctic coast. Newtok is farther along in the very slow process of relocation, but Kivalina is having trouble getting disaster funds in part because of their strong efforts at protecting the community from storm damage.
When we landed in Kivalina in October, a big fall storm had just rolled in, and it was literally eating away at the land. Just erosion was happening right there near the airstrip. And the airstrip is essential for the community to get goods in and out. It's essential in emergencies. It's how you get to the village. And when we got there, crews were working around the clock to fill giant sandbags and shore up the coast and try to prevent any more erosion from happening. They were using their own equipment, their volunteer man hours, their few paying for the fuel, and they were really hoping that a disaster might be declared to help refund some of that money. But because they were successful in preventing a disaster from happening, no disaster, no money. And so there's a real catch-22 here for these villages that are trying to prevent the worst from happening. And they don't want outsiders to come in and say, here's what you should do, here are the solutions. They just want outsiders to listen and help them achieve their goals.
There was a big multi-nation agreement reached in Paris to work on mitigating climate impacts globally. Will this help the villages in Alaska?
Well, you know, Laurie, there was a focus in Paris on helping developing nations adapt to climate change. But the U.S. isn't a developing nation, so it doesn't really qualify. And, you know, that agreement in Paris was hailed by the White House as a success, as a real leap forward. But it's more aspirational than action-oriented. And there are still big questions about how targets for lowering emissions and pollution will actually be met. And Paris didn't yield money, which is really the cold, hard currency that communities need to be able to build new houses or move their old houses to a new community.
Libby, what do you hope this program, When the Water Took the Land, achieves? What's the effort in highlighting the villages here in Alaska?
Well, we discovered that there really isn't a framework in place to plan ahead and help communities decide. There's not a lot of money there in Alaska or in the lower 48. It's just not how our government thinks about it. So I think one of the goals here is to get us all talking about and thinking about the fact that the time has come when we have to have a different dialogue. It's a new way of thinking. But experts that we interviewed said what's happening to Alaska will happen in other places. It will happen in New York State. It will happen in Florida. It will happen in Louisiana. And so Alaska can be this place where lessons learned have a real impact for the communities in places like Kivalina, but also for people around the country. And then it's also just, it's really important to have Alaskans sharing their stories in their own words with a larger audience. And we interviewed one elder, Lucy Adams, in Kivalina, who said, I talk and I talk, and I'm starting to feel like it's not amounting to anything. But the more they tell their story and share it, hopefully the more people will learn and see that this isn't just something to discuss and debate, but it's people's lives, and it's time to figure out how to help them.
Libby Casey is a reporter for Al Jazeera America. The Fault Lines program, When the Water Took the Land, will air on Sunday evening. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Governor Bill Walker's proposed budget would cut $9 million in home heating subsidies for low-income Alaskans. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports on the plan to eliminate the Alaska Heating Assistance Program.
About 800 households throughout the Bristol Bay region receive government assistance with heating their homes each year. While the majority of those are funded by the federal Low-Income Energy Assistance Program, roughly 150 households are served through the state's Alaska Heating Assistance Program. Ray Bell Whitcomb is the director of workforce development at the Bristol Bay Native Association, which administers both federal and state heating assistance for the region.
It takes a single application to apply for services, and depending on what income level that the household qualifies under, determines which pocket of funding that we use to provide the benefit.
So while there will still be federal funds available for the poorest households, Whitcomb says cutting the Alaska Heating Assistance Program would leave a whole segment of the population without help for their heating bills.
The biggest impact is that people need to plan wisely. You know, with the state dividends, it was really important that people actually pay down on their utility bills and not expect that the Heating Assistance Program is going to cover the full year's utilities. It will never be funded at those levels. So just be wise, you know, do some energy efficient improvements around your home, put up some weather stripping around the windows and the doors, you know, change out inefficient heaters, do small things that actually can make a big difference on their utility bills.
The governor's plan is just the first step in the budget cycle. Lawmakers will have a chance to make their own plans when the legislative session begins next month. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, finding a home. More than 2,000 kids in Anchorage are considered homeless by the school district. They stay in shelters, cars, or with family and friends. Research shows kids who lack stability don't do as well in school, but the support of even just one adult can change that. In the case of teenager Jamari House, an entire family stepped in to make sure she didn't get lost in the shuffle. KSKA's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman has more.
Walking into the Houdon household is like entering a giant slumber party mid-swing. Every couple of minutes, this happens. 17-year-old Jamari House sits on a pile of stuffed animals, eating a chicken strip. Her best friend, Angel Houdon, lounges by the couch, and Angel's older sister, Ivory, sits ramrod straight on a kitchen chair, shirt buttoned all the way to the top. The friendly conversation turns into a sisterly squabble, Jamari throwing comments toward her friend-turned-sister.
It's nobody's chore, but you could take the initiative to clean the bathroom.
It's your chore to at least clean the sink. Come on, man.
But you do all the makeup.
Jamari moved in with the Houdons about 3 years ago. She met Ivory in orchestra class. They became friends, and Ivory invited her over one day. Jamari was surprised when they got off the bus from Bartlett High School and walked up to the Houdon split-level house.
I honestly forgot people lived in houses. I really did. Like, because of how many times I've been in apartments or shelters, and my grandma lived in a trailer.
Jamari can remember at least 9 places she's lived with her mother and twin brother, sometimes with her mom's boyfriends, sometimes with relatives. Her dad died when she was only 4. By the time she started high school, she was staying in a 2-bedroom apartment with a crowd of relatives.
We stayed with my cousin who had 5 children and had a baby coming on the way. So that wasn't too fun because the baby would be crying all night or I'd have to babysit and not be able to finish all my homework.
Jamari had always been the smart academic type, but her grades were slipping. She was barely making low B's and C's. Sam, Angel and Ivory's mom, says the first time she met Jamari and heard about her situation, she saw elements of her own childhood, substance abuse and instability. Jamari's personality reflected it.
She was shy, nervous a lot. It took probably about 4 months for her to open up and just be a little giggle fest or an angry ball of I hate homework, which happens a lot now.
One weekend about 3 years ago, Jamari spent the night. They watched The Little Mermaid and played Mario Kart. And then she never really left.
She was here for about 2 weeks and I was like, don't you need to go home, see your mom? And she's like, oh, my mom doesn't care. I was like, okay.
But her mom, Monica House, did care. Monica says she knew she couldn't provide her kids with a stable home. She was struggling with depression and substance abuse after her husband and then her brother and her aunt died. Her son went to live with a friend, and Jamari went to stay with Sam and her kids.
And Sam, her finding Sam, that was the best thing, even if it wasn't with me. That was the best thing could have happened.
And in the 3 years since moving to the Houdon's house, Jamari's grades have climbed. Now she's an A student and is applying to colleges. And she says her personality has changed.
Well, I've gotten more comfortable with myself and with the girls.
I'm sorry.
I'm a bit more able to speak more comfortably. Like, they encourage me.
Ivory, the no-nonsense sister, says Jamari changed their family, too. Jamari moved in soon after Ivory's father moved out. Ivory says, together, they're a real family.
My family interacts, and not only is it the interactions that happen, is that we're able to be happy and angry together. And it used to be where no one's allowed to have emotions, and no one's allowed to really be themselves. After the divorce and people were moving in and out, I got to have a family for once.
Jamari was never legally adopted by Sam, and she still has a relationship with her biological mom. Monica has her own place now, and Jamari spends every other weekend with her. But her new family and her new home have given her roots she's never had before. And even though she's preparing to leave for college, she never wants to give it up.
I'm like, you can't move, Sam. Why? 'Cause it's a safe place. Stability. everything, it's good. Don't move, because if you move, then I'll kind of flip out, because I want to come back to this house. Like, if I move out of state or something and come back and she's moved somewhere else, I'll be like, where did you move? Why aren't you home? Who's these people here?
She finishes her after-school snack, sinking further into the pile of toys and contentedly putting off her pile of homework. She's comfortable, happy, and home. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Katia Simonson, who is 23 and has lived in Soldotna, Kotzebue, and more recently, Chicago. Her roots are in Unalakleet, where she married her husband, Thomas, on July 10th.
We looked back like 5 years, and the average, or the day that had the best weather, on average, we decided we chose July 10th because it looked like the best day in the past 5-10 years. And it actually turned out to be accurate. It was really great weather and just cloudy enough for pictures to be good, and we had a little breeze to keep all the bugs away, and yeah, it was really nice. It was nice, but it was kind of like, all right, after like getting married, and that was like one of the only times that I ever was nervous. I don't get in the moment a lot. Like, I'm the worst when it comes to people surprising me, because he surprised me. Thomas like flew up here like 3 months into us dating. He surprised me, and I came home from a week up at Bible camp, and he's at my kitchen table. It just didn't click in my head. Like, there's no, he doesn't fit in that picture. Like, he's from Sweden. He goes there in the summertime. He's supposed to be there. So my brain couldn't put two and two together. And him and my dad thought, like, based on my reaction, that it was a really bad idea, trying to surprise me. Thomas has even said it himself that he sees another side of me here. That, I don't know, that I haven't learned to be comfortable other places like I'm comfortable here.
49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Ann Hillman, Zachariah Hughes, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger and Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Ann Hillman and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future. Delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.